that the Republicans have been causing so much harm along with the Trump administration. Again, this was something that used to have a lot of bipartisan support. Unfortunately, this withdrawal of SNAP benefits and this cruel way of threatening states and even threatening grocery stores if they help SNAP recipients is a part of a long history in the United States of denying people food in order to put cause chaos and also force people into submission. This is what the United States government did to Native Americans, less than 100 years ago and on beyond that. They used to starve Native Americans into submission in order to steal their land and to force them into compliance with the American government. Finally, I just wanted to say that the right to food is extremely important in this sense. And the climate at the climate summit in Belém, they have insisted that ending poverty and ending hunger is central to ensuring that we address the climate crisis. Food is a fundamental human right. Many states can actually put the right to food in their constitutions. Why should we wait on the federal government, who is not abiding by the rule of law? They're completely absent, morally corrupt, and we need to really, what's amazing is the solidarity that's expressed with people who are poor. I am just so energized and filled with awe at the community groups that have come together to feed their families, that farmers, Black, white, Latino, and Native, have been helping their communities. And many of those farmers and farm workers are also participating in SNAP. So I have lots of hope for the American people coming up with new and creative ideas, including Mayor Mamdani, who wants to have publicly funded grocery stores in the city of New York. There are wonderful new ideas emerging, and I'm just in awe of the American people coming together.
I want to turn to President Trump being interviewed on Monday night by Laura Ingraham on Fox.
Well, SNAP has gone from like 7 billion to many times 7 billion. And, you know, people keep talking about SNAP, but SNAP is supposed to be if you're down and out, you really, really have. That's what the purpose of it. People are getting, they walk in and they get it automatically now. So the number is many times what it should be. It's disgraceful.
Can we change
You wouldn't
that?
Have been able, I'll tell you what, this country would have been busted, 100% busted within 5 months into a new administration
I
didn't win.
Can we reform SNAP
yeah,
and these
I think
benefits
we can reform
so they're used
it.
For the people
I
who
should.
Really need them?
It's meant for people. And you know what it does is it really puts the country at jeopardy. People that need it have to get it. I'm all for it. But people that are able-bodied can do a job. They leave their job because they figure they can pick this up. It's easier. That's not the purpose of it.
So if you can explain, are they now trying to, using this opportunity, to go after people who receive food stamps?
Oh, they already have been doing that. I think in the big, beautiful bill that was passed in the summertime, it's already an indication of what they're trying to do. One thing I would like to remind Trump and his administration is that the vast majority of people who are participating in SNAP are actually, as Trump would say, down and out. That's when I talked about the precarity of the American people, that 50% of the people in the United States don't have enough savings to get them through hard times. Again, while his own workers are waiting in food pantry lines, he doesn't think that people are down and out, that need actual food. So we need to correct him as well. People who are able-bodied, who are receiving SNAP benefits, are actually already working, which I want to insist that the reason that they're on SNAP is because their wages are far too low that to support them being able to pay their rent, pay for health care, and pay for food. That's why so many people tell me about trading off, they're not eating, but in order to take their medicines, or they don't take their medicine because they need to eat. This is why we have a major public health crisis. We are at the verge of a major public health crisis with the healthcare premiums increasing, and it's deeply concerning. This is why we need to have universal healthcare, and also maybe consider if we're going to get rid of SNAP, let's turn it into universal basic income so people are not tied solely to being able to buy groceries, that they can spend their money as they please. There are two major voices that are absent in this entire dialogue, and that would be the food industry. Walmart is the primary redeemer of SNAP benefits. They redeem one quarter of SNAP benefits, and the vast majority of their workers participate in SNAP. Walmart has been completely silent in this. As well, we need to think about Amazon and also the healthcare companies that are increasing the premiums. We need to bring corporations and the government back into line and find ways we can solve, we can promote health and well-being and solve this public health crisis.
And finally, we just passed Veterans Day. Can you talk about veterans receiving food stamps, people who are disabled receiving food stamps?
Yes, very much so. 1.4 million veterans participate in the SNAP program. The vast majority of those veterans are people with disabilities, and those disabilities were created in the combat that they were doing for the United States, mental health challenges. 40% of people who have disabilities in this country report food insecurity, and SNAP is a lifeline for them because their disability benefits are not enough to help support their health and well-being. Not only veterans, but also active duty military. Many active duty military families also participate in SNAP. So we need to be able to support veterans, people who are active duty military, families with children, seniors, and people with disabilities.
Mariana Chilton, we thank you so much for being with us, professor of practice in the Department of Nutrition, School of Public Health and Health Sciences at the University of Massachusetts Amherst, author of the book, The Painful Truth About Hunger in America. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As the House of Representatives moves closer to forcing the release of the Epstein files by the Department of Justice, we turn now to look at a new series by DropSite News looking at Epstein's ties to Israeli intelligence and how he secretly brokered numerous deals for Israeli intelligence. On Tuesday, DropSite revealed an Israeli spy stayed for weeks at a time with Epstein in Manhattan. DropSite has also looked at Epstein's role brokering a security agreement between Israel and Mongolia and Epstein's role in setting up a back channel between Israel and Russia on Syria. This all comes as CNN's revealed today. Epstein mentioned Donald Trump by name multiple times in private correspondence over the last 15 years, according to newly released emails from Democrats in the House Oversight Committee. CNN's reporting the emails show Epstein asserts Trump spent significant time with a woman whom Oversight Democrats describe as a victim of Epstein's sex trafficking. We're joined now by DropSite's Murtaza Hussain, who's been reporting on Epstein with his colleague Ryan Grimm. Murtaza, welcome back to Democracy Now! Explain what you feel the media is not covering. What is the role of Jeffrey Epstein when it comes to U.S. foreign policy?
There's been a lot of justifiable focus on Epstein's very grave crimes and facilitation of the crimes of others related to sex trafficking and sex abuse. But one critical aspect of the story has not been covered is Epstein's own relations to foreign governments, the U.S. governments, and particularly foreign intelligence agencies. Now, this information is not entirely private. A lot of it is out there, actually, in House disclosures as parts of certain lawsuits which have been leveled against Epstein or over Epstein's activities over the past few years. And in a few databases of leaked emails from certain figures around the world which have come out showing extensive contacts with Epstein. So I think that a lot of these coverage of him so far, to date at least, it's focused, again, on salacious details of his life and the crimes he was involved in related to minors and women. But the other aspect, the political aspect, and who he was and the role he played at this very high level, facilitating deals, interacting and liaisoning with intelligence agencies in different parts of the world, has not been covered. We don't know exactly who Epstein was specifically to be in the position to commit the crimes that he was doing. And our story is aiming to focus and shedding light upon one particular aspect, which is Epstein's extensive relationship with Israeli intelligence, U.S. intelligence, and the intelligence agencies of other countries as well, too. He was a deal maker and a fixer at a very, very elite level, and he was making deals that were ultimately wound up, in some cases, being signed as formal security agreements between the government of Israel and other countries. That's what our series is focusing on right now. And it's just coming across naturally looking at the information contained in the publicly available data about his communications over the past, during the period of about 2013 and 2016.
So tell us who Yoni Karin is. You reveal that this senior Israeli intelligence officer lives in one of Epstein's apartments, had close personal ties to former CIA director Leon Panetta. Can you talk about what specific intelligence gathering operations you believe that Karin was conducting from Epstein's apartment? And also, the relationship between Jeffrey Epstein and the former prime minister of Israel, Ehud Barak, which has been documented over and over again.
So a lot of the information we have now coming out about these intelligence ties do come from private correspondence between Barak and Epstein, which were leaked by hackers some years ago and posted online, but have never really been analyzed in great detail, but shed profound light on Epstein's ties, not just to Barak, but officials all over the world in foreign governments in Africa and Central Asia and Europe and Russia, whom he was helping connect Barak with. Interestingly, Barak was relying on Epstein's support rather than vice versa, despite the fact that Barak was a very powerful figure in the Israeli security establishment. So these emails, in addition to House disclosures, which also pointed the same information, showed that this intelligence agent, who was a longtime military intelligence agent in Israel, who was Barak's chief aide for many years, lived at Epstein's house for significant stretches of time, weeks at a time, between this period of 2013-2015. He was staying in Epstein's house. We don't know specifically from the communications what they may have been working on, what his role may have been there, the reason he was staying at his house. Barak would also stay at his house sometimes to hold meetings and to do business in New York. That was facilitated by that. But we do see that they were corresponding. And at one point, Epstein does transfer money to Karin. And there is also communication between Barak and Karin in the inbox, which we believe is coded communication, perhaps referring to dead drops of information or something else in New York City that they're engaged in. It's hard to tell, because part of the reason that this correspondence is interesting is that we knew from the Snowden disclosures many years ago that Barak and Karin were being surveilled by the NSA in New York around this time, or in the United States around this time. So whatever they were doing with Epstein, or in his house, in New York, amongst each other, with money, with sharing information or data or packages or something else, it was taking place in this period. And again, the interesting thing is that even if one were not look at the emails and keep those separate, this information is in the House disclosures. In Jeffrey Epstein's calendars, it's mentioned the Karin's coming and going from his home and the day his departure that he was staying, how long he was staying for. So this is stuff that the media could be covering, the broader media could be covering. It's just escaped attention for reasons which, one can speculate, or it's hard to say exactly. But we're going to continue drilling down this, not shying away from the political implications of his activities, Epstein's activities, and the ties he had with powerful figures like Barak and intelligence agents like Karin.
The leaked email showed that the former prime minister, Ehud Barak, bookmarked a private initiative with Oracle's Larry Ellison. Can you talk about the significance of this initiative?
So what we saw from the email is effectively that around the time that Epstein and Barak were corresponding, that Karin's activities in New York and Epstein's home were going on, Barak himself had gone on to have a separate meeting with Larry Ellison. Now, Larry Ellison is a very well-known pro-Israel donor. He's a billionaire and a founder of Oracle. Currently, he's involved in, with his son, buying up much of the American media. We've done other reporting on Ellison, drawn not from this database, but from a separate database of communications, which are also leaked and are posted on a website called the Distributed Denial Service, Denial of Secrets. And they show that Ellison had been very involved with the Israeli government in other facets, helping, in a way, shape the American political system for Israel. He was helping vet political candidates at the behest of Israeli officials for their favorability towards Israel to determine who he'd give money to. So we don't know from the correspondence with Barak what he was discussing with Ellison at that time, or what the private initiative may have been. There's no further, not everything was discussed by email. A lot of things were discussed by phone, so not everything is documented in that manner. But we do know that Ellison was very closely involved in promoting the perceived interests of the Israel in the United States at that time, and Barak was doing the same thing. And interestingly, Epstein was doing the same thing. Epstein was helping Barak facilitate Israeli interests around the world, different countries, helping him refine his pitches, connecting with people to help pursue, the geopolitical interests of the Israeli government. And this is all coming as for one parcel of that. And so at Barack's meeting with Ellison, one can imagine it would have something to do with the ongoing efforts he'd be engaged in.
And the leaked emails showing Jeffrey Epstein and Barack securing a private meeting with Vladimir Putin in 2013 to orchestrate the removal of Bashar al-Assad. I mean, it didn't succeed. But in an email exchange, Epstein wrote to the former prime minister of Israel, "With civil unrest exploding in Ukraine, Syria, Somalia, Libya, and the desperation of those in power, isn't this perfect for you?" Barack replied, "You're right in a way, but not simple to transform it into a cash flow, a subject for Saturday," Ehud Barack wrote. Can you talk about, as we wrap up, that relationship between Jeffrey Epstein and Ehud Barack attempting to profit from the war in Syria?
Well, that email that you just read out is a very important email because it kind of explains the broader thesis that Epstein and Barack have been operating under and what they've been doing exactly. They've been going around the world pitching Barack as someone who could solve the security problems of different countries and introducing him to powerful people in these countries. We're going to cover more of those in the weeks and months to come. And telling them that Barack, through his connections with the Israeli intelligence and Israeli intelligence-linked surveillance technology firms especially, could help introduce them to these countries, embed them, and then later sign formal deals with Israel. We did a story about this, how it manifested in Cote d'Ivoire, also Mongolia. In this tie with Russia, it's very fascinating because Epstein was the one who's arranging a back channel between Barack and Putin to discuss this deal to remove Bashar al-Assad and replace him with putatively, you know, a pro-Russian dictator who Israel was also okay with. That didn't come to pass. But I think that the interactions show tremendous access that Epstein enjoyed, not just to Israeli officials or U.S. officials, but also to Russian officials. He had the ability to get meetings with Putin. He met with Putin himself on numerous occasions, according to his own correspondence. And, you know, that is something that, you know, how did that come about? What was the background behind that? We don't know. But we do know that at the very least, Epstein was somebody who considered himself to have the ability to access high-level Russian officials. He claimed in the emails, as I mentioned, that he met Putin or Putin asked to meet him. That's Epstein's own depiction of the interaction. But he did absolutely have the juice to get Barack in the room with Putin. And the funny thing is that Barack had to rely on Epstein for that, to create that back channel. It shows the tremendous influence and power that Epstein had, which does not really, you know, we have not had a full accounting of that. That has not been accounted for in our public understanding of this case. We hope to shed more light on that in our own reporting, but we need the government, we need other news outlets to pay attention to this and put together the pieces of who Epstein was and the role he played as an international dealmaker.
Murtaza Hussain, I want to thank you for being with us, national security reporter at Dropsite News. We'll link to your new articles about Jeffrey Epstein's ties to Israeli intelligence. Coming up, put your soul on your hand and walk. A new documentary on Gaza by the acclaimed Iranian director Sepideh Farsi.
That scenes of destruction on every hand. Black waters, black waters rise
Blackwaters, performed by Nora Brown, Stephanie Coleman, in our Democracy Now! Studio. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. We end today's show with the renowned Iranian filmmaker, Sepideh Farsi, the director of the new documentary, Put Your Soul on Your Hand and Walk. The film, based on regular video calls Sepideh made with the Palestinian photojournalist Fatma Suna in Gaza over the course of a year, from April 2024 to April 2025. This is the trailer for the film.
Where are you now? Your position?
Gaza. This is my neighborhood. No one lived here or there. There's no one.
When the war started on October 7th, I started filming Palestinian refugees who were just arriving from Gaza. One of them, I came to know Fatem.
I am a photographer.
Yes, I saw your photos.
This is my world. Okay. I find my in this. I am trying to find some life in this world, in this death. Every second you walk in the street, you put your soul on your hands and walk. I'm shaking. It's very close.
Each of our conversations could be the last one. So every time we connect and I can see her face, it feels like a miracle.
Just like this. Go without any goodbyes.
Meeting her was like a mirror held in front of me. How much both our lives are conditioned by walls and wars.
You look good.
Are you? We live a very simple life, and they want to take this simple life from us. Why?
I don't know if this will end or not. But I must keep going, and I must document everything. To be me.
Look at that smile. The trailer for the new documentary, Put Your Soul on Your Hand and Walk, by the acclaimed Iranian filmmaker Sepeda Farsi, based on calls with the Palestinian photojournalist Fatma Sona in Gaza. Last April 15th, the documentary was accepted to the Cannes Film Festival. On the following day, Fatma was killed, along with almost her whole immediate family, except for her mother, in an Israeli airstrike on her home in northern Gaza. Sepeda Farsi joins us now in our New York studio here for Doc NYC, where the film is playing on Thursday at 12:45 in the afternoon at Village East. Incredible documentary. Talk more about Fatma, who you call Fatem.
Yes.
And you had to change the end of the documentary. We spoke to you the day after she was killed.
I first didn't want to change the film at all because I wanted it to remain as it was when she was alive. And it took me a few weeks and a few days only before the Cannes premiere. I decided to end the film with the last moments we spent together when she learned about the selection. And it's something that I will never get over. I mean, it was documented by forensic architecture. It was a targeted attack. I do not understand how, I mean, Israeli government and army are eliminating journalists and photographers just for doing their jobs. And she was just a photographer.
Well over 200, and you point out 28 women.
Yes,
journalists.
More even. I think we're beyond 300 now. And you know what? Just a few hours before the ceasefire, the so-called ceasefire, which is not one, in my opinion, went into effect officially, they rebombed their house again. They destroyed it fully, meaning that there is no proof of what happened now. But forensic had luckily investigated it. It's online. I don't know what to say, but she was. Her light is still there.
Now, you weren't with her because journalists couldn't go into Gaza. So you had this series of phone calls, video phone calls. I wanted to go back to another excerpt from Put Your Soul on Your Hand and Walk as you continue to speak with the Palestinian photojournalist, now dead, Fatema Hassan.
Have you lost weight because of the food?
Yes, of course. Of course. Now I... You see, my mind is very massive, and I have no focus because I have no healthy food or good food even. Mm-hmm. So I feel that I can't even stand up, you know, and I can't talk even. Every day I told my mom, I want a chicken. I hope or I wish if we had just chicken because we didn't eat it for 9 months.
We met the first time, I think, 2 months ago, and it was already 7 months of the war. And you told me you had chicken once. I think I've
yeah.
watching the.
Now, my biggest dream to so have one chicken and one chocolate. Yes, I told my friend in the south, just send me one chocolate. I miss everything. I miss my life. Miss the food that was my mom cooked. The chocolate and Nescafe and coffee. Mm. Everything.
Again, Fatim, on April 15th, you told her your film about her got into the Cannes Film Festival. Talk about her response, and the next day, she's killed in an Israeli airstrike.
She was so delighted. She was shining. She was shining all the time. But
you said to her,
day,
"Do you know Ken? Do you know Ken?"
Yes.
She said, "Yes, yes."
Yeah. And then she's like, "What? Fabulous!"
And
I'm
you
coming.
Invited her.
Yes. And I was on the visa. I would have gotten the visa almost. It was almost ready. She sent me her passport. All of that very quickly. And my concern was to get her out the Israeli checkpoints. But never ever I thought she'd be targeted like the day after. And I still don't know. Who made that decision? Obviously, nobody knows, apart from the IDF. But her light and her joy were amazing, yes. And you know what, Amy? We all die one day. This is the question I ask myself. Why do people do this? We'll all die, all of us. So those people who make these decisions and who kill such a person, why do they do that?
You talk about, with Fatim, often about religion. And
yes.
She talks about why it's so important to her. You're an Iranian filmmaker. She was a Gazan photojournalist. And she introduces you so often to the different members of her family
yes.
and her friends, little girls and boys. Talk more about this.
We had become family. My family knew her. Her family knew me. We were really... I know about those little kids who have grown up who are thinner because they don't have food to eat, but they're 1 year older. The two of them are alive, luckily. The mother has survived. The rest of those whom you see in the film are all gone, were killed. And I think that their resilience, the way they resist this permanent occupation and the genocide is so amazing that keeping hope, as she used to say, hope is a dangerous thing. She was quoting Shawshank Redemption, which is a strange thing for a girl who never left Gaza in her whole life. You know, she was so knowledgeable and great. She was so talented.
Mm. And so you dedicate the film at the end to her family. Who exactly died in the strike?
Fatim, two of her sisters, Wala and Ala. Ala was 5 months pregnant. Three of the brothers, Muhammad, and Yazan, 20, 15, and 10. Her father, Raed, and Fatim herself.
Hmm. And her work as a photojournalist. Talk about that in this last 30 seconds.
Yes. There are many exhibitions around the world, hopefully soon in the U.S. There was a book published in France called Les Yeux de Gaza, Eyes of Gaza. I'm trying to get it out in the U.S. as well. Many books, many exhibitions. She's going to get an honorary PhD from the Canary University, Las Palmas. Many things are done to her. A man just took her photo to Vatican because he wrote to me, I'm going there, I'm going to take her photo with me. People are walking for Fatah.
Sepi Defarsi, award-winning Iranian filmmaker, director of the new documentary, Put Your Soul on Your Hand and Walk. It's going to be premiering here in New York at Doc NYC at Village East Thursday at 12:45. But it's also in theaters around the country.
Right now,
also at IFC. Democracy Now!, the film about it, Steal the Story, Please, will be shown at two theaters here in New York, at the SVA Theater and at IFC Thursday and Friday. On Saturday, I'll be speaking twice in Amsterdam, in the Netherlands, at the Royal Theater Carré. The film will show there at 5:15 and 8:30 on Saturday night. Hope to see people in Amsterdam. That does it for our show. I'm Amy Goodman. This is Democracy Now! Check our website at democracynow.org for details about the film's showing.
Thank you for listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby, British Columbia.
Thank you for supporting our annual fundraising campaign. From the bottom of our hearts, thank you for helping us rise higher and reach further.